Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Today, Eddie Gloud Jr. on what it means to be an American. I've been asking writers and musicians, activists and poets to reflect on that question. Mr. Gloud is a native son of Mississippi. He grew up in a small town near Pascagoula. His mother supervised a group of cleaners at a shipyard. His father was the second African-American postman hired in Pascagoula. Eddie Gloud is now a professor of religion at Princeton, where he chairs the Department of African American Studies, and his newest book is titled Democracy in Black. He joins us today from Princeton. Welcome, and our first name's all right in the conversation.
Oh, absolutely. It's a delight to be with you.
And really a pleasure to have you with us as well today. Now, I've begun each interview asking for my guest's interpretation of a phrase from a Langston Hughes poem that I know you are very familiar with. So this was kind of meant to be. That poem is Let America Be America Again. And the phrase is, let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Will you tell me what that phrase says to you?
Sure. There's always been the idea that America is and has always been a kind of beacon of freedom for the world. The Redeemer Nation, the city on the hill, as John Winthrop called it, or Ronald Reagan described it as the shining city on the hill. So this idea that America is an example of democracy achieved, but in that moment with Langston Hughes, it is a dream deferred, right? That this idea of America as a beacon of freedom, as the Redeemer Nation, as the city on the hill, just simply did not ring true for large numbers of folks, specifically African Americans. So at that moment, it calls to mind for me at least, the underside of America, that America has never quite been what it has said it is and was.
And there's where the tension and the anger is in that poem, because Hughes has written this kind of refrain that talks back to the poem. I mean, it contradicts the ideal at the center of it. At least that's how I see it. What would you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the thing is that there's one thing for us to posit the notion that America is an example of democracy achieved, that America is, in fact, a kind of instantiation of the principles of freedom, liberty, and equality. It's one thing to say that and to state that as our ideals, but it's another thing to look at our practices. Even the opening quotations for this segment, that assertion, those assertions of America's commitment to equality and liberty, those assertions have weight because they're happening in a context in which there's a denial of liberty and equality to others. I mean, it's almost as if we have to say it in order to really believe it, because in the face of our actual lived practices, we're constantly running up against this contradiction.
I'm so glad you mentioned the voices in that open, because they come from a lot of different life experience. I mean, you hear Eleanor Roosevelt, Condoleezza Rice, Ronald Reagan, Shirley Jackson. And each of them is holding up, I mean, as in the Hughes poem, holding up this ideal, but also acknowledging that for all of our commitment to those ideals, we constantly struggle in a lot of different ways, as we are during this election season, to meet those ideals.
Right. And, you know, for me, I want to change the subject. I want to change the terrain upon which we think about America. Because when we think about the problem as a problem between, or the problem as a kind of gap between our ideals and our practices, it allows us to be to proclaim ourselves as committed to democracy while simultaneously being racist, being sexist, being classist, being all the things that we do in our practices, right? So as if our practices somehow contradict our ideals, when in fact our practices may very well reveal what we're truly committed to.
Okay, so explain what you mean by that.
Right. So oftentimes we tell ourselves a story that America is this beacon of freedom. And that's all we need to do is to align our practices with our ideals. In other words, if we act better, mm-hmm. right, we will live up and to our stated principles. We will achieve our country. And so when it's framed in that way, Carrie, it's an argument always about America instead of about who we take ourselves to be, who you and I are. I actually believe that our practices, the things that we do day in and day out, reveal what we're actually committed to. And if we look at American history, what we see over and over again, right, is a fundamental commitment to the belief that white people matter more than others. There's a fundamental commitment to a society that seems to be stratified, that's predicated upon hierarchies that are based on specious notions of difference. And so I hold the view that if America is to be a beacon of freedom and a light of democracy, we have to do kind of self-interrogation. We have to kind of understand who we take ourselves to be and what gets in the way of us becoming the kinds of people that democracies require. And here's a quick example. Abraham Lincoln thought slavery was a monstrous injustice. And yet he believed that white people were superior to black people.
Mm-hmm.
So Abraham Lincoln couldn't become the kind of person that his vision of democracy required because his understanding of white people blocked the way to him becoming that person. So you have the ideal stated, and then you have the actual practices. So I'm more interested in turning to what we're doing and how what we're doing distorts and disfigures who we take ourselves to be.
Do you think the mythology around who we are as Americans and what America is gets in the way of accomplishing what you've just described?
Absolutely. You know, it's almost, we tell ourselves we're always on the road to a more perfect union.
Mm-hmm.
We tell ourselves that we're inherently good. It's almost like we're never, never land, right? That is to say, it's like Peter Pan's Never Never Land. You know, what's so distinctive about that is that it's a perpetual state of adolescence where you don't have to take responsibility, where you can revel in the illusion of innocence, right? And so whenever you see the horror of your practice, the horror of your doing, you're surprised, you're shocked. And so it gets in the way of us looking the ugliness of who we are squarely in the face. And in that sense, we can never grow up, right? We stay in this kind of comfort zone, almost like Eugene O'Neill's Iceman Cometh, where we just stay at the bar drinking, trading in our illusions, right?
I think the subtext in this series, as I've talked to a lot of different people about it, Roseanne Cash and Louis mm-hmm. Soureya and others, has been, there is a tension and a discomfort with how this idea of we the people is mm-hmm. changing, right? What we are to one another collectively. Yeah. Is that part of what we're wrestling with here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Carnegie Foundation just released a report saying that for the first time, there are more black and brown babies have been born than white babies. The demographic shift has happened. And then you combine that with the scare of 2012, that the fact that we elected a president without the majority of white people voting for him.
Mm.
Everything is changing. The world is changing. This country is changing. And we find ourselves in the throes of a kind of unsettled reaction to not only the demographic shifts, but the failed economic philosophy that has left so many people behind as the world is changing at this extraordinary pace. America is not a white nation and will never be one again. And that upsets folk, right? So much so that we have to kind of create these this odd phrase, a majority-minority nation. What does that mean?
what does that mean?
It's an attempt to try to say that, you know, that those folks who are now minorities make up the majority of the people in the country, as opposed to saying that America is this extraordinary multiracial, multi-ethnic space, right? It's an attempt to kind of hold on to these divisions that have defined our history since our inception. So I think there is a profound ambivalence, a profound fear about what the future holds for so many Americans who have invested in a particular understanding of who we are as Americans and who this country, what this country is.
The other thing that I've been thinking about is, as we've kind of investigated what it is that holds a democracy like America together, is how dangerous it is to have the kind of, as you just noted, economic inequality that we have in this country, and what that portends for this idea of who we are as we the people. Will you give some thought to that? What does that say to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you have this kind of inequality, when you have the top 0.1%, you know, garnering most of the wealth, while the bottom 99% struggle to make ends meet, to imagine a future for their children and their children's children, you set the conditions for not only instability, but you set up the conditions for wholesale chaos and possible revolution. Even Barack Obama in his last State of the Union talked about the new economy and that it was defined by unacceptable, unsustainable inequality. And so you have people who are left behind. You have people who are hardworking, who play by the rules, who dream for their children, who are struggling to imagine how they're going to get their feet out of the quicksand. In fact, how they're going to keep their nose and chin above the quicksand, right? And so when you have that combined with, you know, this history, this historical theater of American race, you know, James Baldwin is fond of saying that America is like a monotonous minstrel show. The same old songs, the same old jokes, the same old dances. We've done the song, you know, we've done the dances so long we could do it in our sleep. And you combine that, the kind of the theater of race that has defined this country since its beginning, with this kind of stark economic reality, then, you know, we are on the horizon of deep, deep chaos. As to paraphrase Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we have some really difficult days ahead.
What about the idea that there has to be an acknowledgement among the people for whom this economy is working and for whom this democracy brings a lot of benefits, that if everyone is not benefiting, I mean, this is the President Obama mm-hmm. talks a lot about the lifting of all boats, right? But that it cannot be okay and the democracy cannot be strong if people with the least are not also experiencing the benefits of this democracy and this economy, and that you have to care about that if you're on one side of that equation.
Yeah, I think the first thing you're absolutely right. The first thing we have to do is we have to separate our understanding of democracy from our understanding of how the economy works. We live in a society where a kind of what you might describe as an economism defines, right, public value. Right. When we want to test the pulse, the health of this nation, we look at the GDP. Right. And what that means, right, is that the economy becomes the measure right. of our moral and ethical standing. Right. When in fact, what should be the measure is how many children are in poverty in this country, how many people are starving in this country, how many people don't have a roof over their heads in this country. Right. That we're not educating all of our children. That people are working 40, 60 hours a week and they're not making a livable wage. And so when you have a certain kind of market logic defining, right, the health and well-being of a country, then the oligarchs win. And then you have a rhetoric around those who are not winning in the economy that something must be wrong with them. So the traditional rhetoric around black Americans, whether they're lazy, they want government handouts, that they are dysfunctional, they live in a culture of poverty. That rhetoric has now, um, uh, it and we can tell a history of it always being related to poor white people, has now acquired a certain kind of currency in talking about the black poor, or the white poor, their opioid addiction, they're drinking too much, they're not going to college, they're not, you know, this. So it's their fault, as opposed to an economic philosophy that has overrun, right, the values of democracy, that has overrun what constitutes democratic virtue. And so we have to do some serious work in not only saying to those in the top one-tenth of a percent, in the top 1%, that you have to share, but we have to do some work to suggest that this way of imagining a society is unsustainable, that this can't be the basis of our mutual living together, in which there's some people who have, and then some people who are not only invisible, but they're disposable. That seems to me not only wrong, it seems to me not only unsustainable, Carrie, it seems to me evil.
When you say we have to do some serious work, you know, where does that begin and what does that look like? I think the country thought in 2008, after we elected President Obama, that we'd done some of that work. And right? And we were eager to say we did the work and now we're moving past that. Well, the last 8 years have shown us that we haven't, the work isn't done, and now I hear you saying that. So what is that work? What's it look like?
Well, I mean, we have to do the work in a variety of ways and in our various lanes. So this kind of conversation that you've been having is one way of doing that work. I think there's a sense in which 2008, the activism that preceded it, I mean, people forget that folks were in the street protesting the Iraq War, that you had people who were already organizing against police brutality. You had folk fighting for livable wage. Barack Obama emerged and he jumped in front of that extraordinary organizing energy and became its object. And then we green screened him, right? We made him whatever we wanted him to be. He became the anti-war president. He became the anti-Wall Street president. In fact, when in fact he was neither of those things, right? And so once he got elected, many of those folks had to figure out what they were going to do, how they were going to kind of, because they were demobilized once he got elected, right? And so they had to figure out how they were going to reconstitute themselves. And then we got Occupy, and then we got Black Lives Matter, and then, and then Fight for 15 and a range of other kinds of efforts across the country at the local grassroots level. And we see that activism and we see that energy, and that energy produced a Bernie Sanders. See, people get it. I think they get it backwards. They think Bernie Sanders caused something when he's the effect of something. And when we organize, right, when we're organized and the demos is active, we will produce better choices. At the political level, at the representational level. So I think what we have to do is engage in ongoing activism. We have to be organized. We have to express a progressive agenda that insists on some basic things, that everyone should have a roof over their heads, that everyone should be able to work and have a livable wage, that every child should be educated, that everyone should have access to college. Everyone should, in effect, have the ability not only to dream dreams, but to make those dreams a reality. And that doesn't seem to be too far-fetched in a country that is the richest country in the history of the world. And so that's the kind of work we're going to do. And so folks tell me when I'm on Morning Joe or something like that, Carrie, they say that I'm one of the crazies. They say you got the crazies on the right and the crazies on the left, right? And you kind of say, oh, so you want to equate that vision of the world with people who are rolling around in hate. That's what you're equating is the same. That makes no sense to me, but it is what it is, right?
You know, when I hear you describe that active, looking ahead, optimism, activity, I think that's on one end of a spectrum of the conversation we're having. And then I see all this nostalgia for maybe America that never was, but America that is not going to be and isn't right as it is today. But the contrast, maybe that's inevitable. Do you think it is?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the beautiful thing and the challenging thing about democracy is that it's messy. There's no pristine space that we stand in to give voice to the values that we hold, that we think ought to animate our form of life. And so there are going to be folks who disagree with us. There are going to be folks who stand in a kind of place where they're reaching for a past that never was, or they're reaching for a past where certain populations were in their place, right? Where white privilege, for example, wasn't challenged, where there was a kind of cultural assumption that your standing was secured, even if you were in Appalachia, in relation to these other folks, right? And so we have to understand that those positions are there, and we have to together have the argument that vision of America, that vision of the world, is not only wrong, that vision of the world is just simply wrong. And we want to put forward a different vision and convince our fellows that this is the best way that they should imagine a future for their families and for their children's children. So that's an argument we have to have, right? That's what it means to be committed to the demos, right? I mean, this is, you asked this question about we the people, right? Mm-hmm. You remember you said that.
Yeah.
And this is Lincoln's famous, Abraham Lincoln's wonderful definition of democracy, that it's a country of the people, for the people, and by the people, right? And what African-American politics has been about, what progressive struggles have been about, I think, is expanding who those people are, right? Broadening our vision of who those folks are. So when those SNCC organizers in Mississippi brought sharecroppers in the courtroom, a rural courtroom, and the judge asked them, why are you bringing these folk here? These are Americans, right? Expanding our understanding of the demos, right? And understanding these fugitive moments as moments where we have to step in and resist so that we can perhaps change the course of the nation. So I understand the other side of it, Carrie. I'm not naive to believe that folks aren't thinking in the way you suggest, but that's democracy. So we got to get out and do the dirty work of making the argument for our side.
If you're tuned in this hour, you're listening to the newest conversation in the series of What It Means to Be an American. You can hear my discussions with Claudia Rankine, Roseanne Cash, Jossie Ross, and others. Eddie Gloud Jr. is with us this morning. He's a professor of religion at Princeton. His newest book is Democracy in Black. Up the road, someone's gonna hurt you like you hurt me. Further on up the road, baby, you just wait and see. I understand that you are a fan of Bobby Blue Bland. How does his music speak to you?
Oh my God, it reminds me of home. You know, the beauty of growing up on the coast of Mississippi. Especially, I grew up Catholic, so on Fridays we didn't eat meat. You know, we would have our fish fries, and the adults would drink their brown liquor, and we would listen to, you know, Bobby Blue Bland or Johnny Lee Hooker or B.B. King or transition to some Al Green or, you know, some deep soul, and it kind of washed away. The week, you know, it kind of gave you a sense of what it means to be free, to just be, you know. It's just, so whenever I hear Bobby Blue Bland and the effortlessness of his voice, and it just reminds me of my mama and her good cooking and what it meant to grow up in a community that loved me unconditionally.
I think your mama might like a little Al Green, so why don't we play some of that too? All right?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely.
But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Talking about how she can make it right, yeah. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody.
Eddie, will you tell me a little bit about growing up in this area of Mississippi and then how that informs who you are today in this conversation that we're having right now?
Yeah, you know, Moss Point is kind of a predominantly African-American town right next to Pascagoula, Mississippi. Pascagoula is, you know, place where former Senator Trent Lott's from. the place where William Faulkner honeymooned. Mm. It's a beautiful coastal town. It's the third coast with the best seafood on the planet. You know, I went to a predominantly black high school, as obviously. I was pretty advanced, so that I was in most of my classes, though, were majority white. My dad is a stern man, wasn't very affectionate. We had a vexed relationship. I grew up with a kind of deep-seated fear and anxiety about whether or not he loved me. Mm-hmm. But my mother was and is amazing. And I grew up with my grandmother and my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother, Ruby Wilson, used to be a domestic worker in Pascagoula. She retired with dimes, and she had this wonderful stove and refrigerator that she bought with the dimes she made. Mm-hmm. She earned in the houses of folks on the coast of Mississippi. And she made the best pinto beans and the best Kool-Aid on the planet. And we would walk in that little starter house, and there would just be nothing but love. And they knew they had a precocious kid in me and my sister. My sister graduated valedictorian of our high school and then went on to go to Spelman College in Atlanta. She came home one day and told me, "You're too white.
To you?
You need to find out something about yourself." And so I applied, because I was integrating Mississippi, and I was integrating my hometown rather in really interesting ways, because, you know, I was involved in politics. I was a special guest of the Democratic Party to the 1984 convention in San Francisco.
Wow.
So I saw the Tale of Two Cities speech and Jesse Jackson's speech and, you know, Mario Cuomo's speech and Jesse Jackson's speech. I saw all of Jesse Jackson's delegates boo Coretta Scott King and Andy Young and all. And I was 14, 15 years old. I was the first African-American elected the youth governor of the state of Mississippi, mm-hmm. when we used to have those Mississippi YMCA youth legislatures. So I was really on my way to becoming a politician. And my sister came home from Spelman and said, "You're too white," and said, "You should go here." And I wanted to run away from home anyway. So I went to a summer science program in Morehouse and didn't come home. I just stayed there.
What do you mean you just stayed?
I didn't finish high school. I just left.
Wow.
I walked into the admissions off the dean of admissions, Sterling Hudson, and I said, "Let me convince you to admit me to college now." I was a rising senior at the time. I was a junior, so I was going to be a senior the next year. And I walked in and I said, "I don't want to go home, but I want to convince you to admit me now." And I walked out of there with a scholarship, and my life has never been the same.
You are a persuasive man, then and now.
Blessed.
This idea of geography of the South, yeah. is something that I talked about with Roseanne Cash. Now, she was born in Memphis. She spent a lot of time in the summers, you know, with her father and extended family in Tennessee and other places. But she moved away, and she's been in New York for a long time, and yet she has constantly felt this pull of where the South intersects with her idea of American identity. So we pulled a little bit from that conversation. I want you to listen to it.
I love the resonance of geography, particularly how Memphis is a totally different feeling than Detroit, you know, and that Los Angeles is really different than Charleston. You know, and the singular things that make a place a place. I do carry some of that. I always say Memphis is a movable feast. You know, I was born there. I didn't grow up there, but I took it with me when I left.
What does that say to you?
Oh, she's absolutely right. And, you know, I always tell my students when I teach the Great Migration that Memphis is just Mississippi. A bunch of Mississippi Negroes who were too tired to get to Chicago. So, I ran away from home to go to college, and then I found myself leaving Atlanta and going to Philly, and then from Philly to New Jersey, and then New Jersey to Brunswick, Maine. I thought I was going to end up in Canada at some point, but Mississippi, Moss Point, just kept. I couldn't shake it. It has fundamentally shaped me. The smells, you know, school, the beginning of school. Was always kind of, you know, connected with the smell of fall and the porgy plant, or dusk, and you could smell the paper mill, or you could drive down, you know, a small main street and see the shrimp truck. Or, you know, on Christmas when we would, my mother would make a big pot of gumbo, seafood gumbo, and we would make warm eggnog with, my grandmother would make it from scratch and put scrap iron in it, right? And, you know, they had the pot for the adults and then the little pot for the kids, and we would try to sneak the pot from the adults. Just the sounds and the smells, you know, the tactile nature of the place, these gorgeous old magnolia trees with moss hanging down from the top all the way to the street. You know, that's why it's called Moss Point. So it's stunning. And then the sadness. There's something about the South that is so fundamentally American, right? The soil, right, is soaked with the blood of our contradiction. The region is haunted. And it's haunted by its past and present. And so you have this amazing civility, you know, the smile, you know, Southern hospitality is real. Once you cross over into my home state, you know, people are smiling. I went to Bozo's, this wonderful seafood place, Carrie, when I was home for my homecoming recently to go take my, I usually come home to take my mama to the fair. And I came home a week early and I was going to get me this 12-inch, this 12-inch seafood po' boy. And I walk into this place and this real grisly, stereotypical Southern white man says, "Hey, don't I see you on television?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Boy, you look as good in person as you do on television." And then he said, "I disagree with much of what you say, but keep saying it." Mm-hmm. Now, underneath that, though, underneath that extraordinary warmth and love and hospitality, is all of this ugliness that can, you know, that you just scratch the surface, you can see. So it's just part of the tragic beauty of the place where I'm from.
You know, when you said a moment ago that there is something so essentially American about the South, I thought, see, this is in some ways the exceptional nature of America, that so many of us identify with the landscapes in which we grew up, and we have such varied landscapes. I mean, people that grew up in the West would say the same, right? The freedom, the big spaces, the sense of independence.
Yeah.
Right. And yet we bring that landscape experience together in our best of times, right? As a collective.
Yeah. I mean, this is why, you know, I'm not a patriot, but there's something about this place that affords us an opportunity to really offer a direction for the world. Right? There's something about this place, you know, and maybe I've been reading too much of James Baldwin, but, you know, we have been overrun by unbridled ugliness since our founding. We've always reconciled the beauty of our principles, the power of our principles, with the ugliness of our practice, to go back to our earlier formulations. You know, give voice to the idea of liberty and freedom, and we reconcile it with racial slavery. We imagine radical reconstruction, and we invent convict leasing and Jim Crow. People sing "We Shall Overcome" and put their bodies on the line in the mid-20th century. And we have the tax revolt of California, Northern California, and the calls for law and order. We can even elect a black president. And then we see the vitriol of the Tea Party and the wholesale attack on voting rights. And that cuts across our, you know, memories of landscape, our tactile relation to the places where we're born. Kind of cuts to the heart of all of us.
You used a word a moment ago that I have not used at all in these conversations, because I didn't want people to think what it means to be an American should be equated with patriotism. But I'm interested in why you declared that the way you did.
You know, patriotism for me is a form of idolatry, right? And you know, idolatry is one of the key features of the evils in the world, right? One of the key motivating factors of the evil in the world, where people worship, you know, whether it's money, whether it's status, whether it's country, whether it's even the idolatry of doctrine, right? Whether it's, you know, a particular rigid understanding of Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or whatever. So these idols, right? These idols carry are sources of safety, right? They secure us from the messiness of the world. And, you know, James Baldwin says in The Evidence of Things Not Seen, which he's writing about the Atlanta child murders, he says, if you dare to really fundamentally change, you have to give up the illusion of safety. You have to risk yourselves. So I don't want to fall into the comfort of the idolatry of love of country. Plus, you got selective patriots out there, you know, people who only think that they can be patriotic. Other people, when they critique the country in the name of a love for the country, they get dismissed and told to sit down or to stand up in Colin Kaepernick's case, mm-hmm. and be quiet. So,
have you felt that you've had to explain? I mean, that is a very, I think, a very poetic explanation that you just gave us for this. But have you been called upon to explain your views on that before? Because, mm-hmm. you know, that sets off a little alarm among some people.
Yeah, you know, when I first wrote Democracy in Black, I wrote that we had to become traitors for democracy. Right. Hmm. And my editor's like, nah, Eddie, no. And so then it got translated because I was playing on what the New York, the NYPD did to the mayor when they turned their backs on him at the funeral. You remember that?
Yeah.
And so I said, we need to turn our backs, right, on practices that undermine democracy. But that was just me cashing out what I meant by traitor. So it went from traitor to turn our backs. So I think, you know, we need to be traitors for democracy. We need to be traitors for love. We need to turn our backs on these practices that get in the way of us standing in right relation with one another. And, you know, I was speaking to some young folks the other day, and I said, you know, sometimes you got to sing off key to be heard. And sometimes you have to say those things in these moments, right, that will single you out for a certain kind of negative treatment. But you have to be bold and cultivate the habits of courage in those moments. Otherwise, you'll cultivate the habits of cowardliness. So we have to speak the truth. We have to speak our truth with passion in these moments. So I think we need to be traitors, Carrie.
I think it takes a lot of bravery, and I know you're acknowledging that, to sing off key when everyone else is singing from the same page in tune.
Yeah.
It asks a lot of people, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Because, you know, sometimes one of our problems, and you heard this, when you read Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail, he's making a similar claim, right? And that is, there's a kind of complicity. And this goes all the way back to Emerson's argument in Self-Reliance. There's a kind of complicity with the status quo. And oftentimes when we sing off key, right, it's to call attention to the fact that we're all singing a tune that we shouldn't be singing, right? It's not just for your own individual brand. It's not for some kind of crude adolescent individualism. You sing off key for a purpose, for a reason, to call attention to something, not just yourself, right? Not yourself, but to call attention to something. And you know, this is one of the beauties of America, going back to our theme, is that there's always been this tradition of people singing off key. Right? And I stand in that tradition.
One of the things that Dr. King says in that letter from Birmingham is that he's cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. He says, I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not mm-hmm. be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This really goes right back to what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation.
It's at the core. And, you know, I was talking with some folks yesterday in Washington, D.C., and this young woman asked me this question about intersectionality, talking about, you know, what does it mean to talk so much about race and not be attentive to questions of gender and patriarchy, to think about homophobia and the like? And how do we, she asked me, model a kind of politics that reflects all of these identities? And I said in response, we have to model a politics that's predicated upon justice. And what is justice? Justice is standing in right relation with our fellows. And what does that mean? That means we have to imagine a society of non-domination, right? And that cuts across everything. So when Dr. King makes that move in the letter, it's the best of the Black freedom tradition. It's the best of our tradition in the sense that, you know, the argument for Black freedom is an argument for a much more just society. It's not an argument for us to retreat into our insular communities because that's just simply another idol of safety. But it's to help us to imagine a genuine mutuality that allows us to stitch together a society in which the good of all of us is evidenced in our arrangements, right? The beauty and power and dignity of every ordinary human being is seen in the very ways in which the values that we embrace animate everything we do, right? So just injustice anywhere, you know, I mean, that formulation is key, right, to a kind of radical politics that we desperately need in these times.
Here's President Obama earlier this year in Selma, I think reflecting some of what Dr. King wrote, some of what we've been talking about this morning. So let's listen.
That's what it means when we say America is exceptional. For we were born of change. We broke the old aristocracies, declaring ourselves entitled not by bloodline, but endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. We secure our rights and responsibilities through a system of self-government, of and by and for the people. That's why we argue and fight with so much passion and conviction, because we know our efforts matter. We know America is what we make of it.
I love the people that are calling out in the crowd. This idea of American exceptionalism, is it misunderstood?
No, and you know, that bothers the hell out of me.
Why?
because at that moment, what President Obama has done is he seamlessly yoked the Black freedom tradition to this idea of America as an exceptional place, American exceptionalism. Remember, I made a shift earlier in the conversation. I wanted to move from an idea of the exceptional nature of America to our practices.
Right.
That the problem isn't a gap between our ideals and our practices. The problem actually rests in our practices, right? That our practices reveal our ideals. They reveal our commitments. But what in that moment in Selma, and it's a really symbolically significant moment. What President Obama was doing was drawing a seamless connection between the Black freedom tradition and American exceptionalism. In fact, the Black freedom tradition becomes, in his hands, exemplary of the exceptional nature of America. I want to argue that exceptionalism blocks the way to us criticizing,
mm-hmm.
blocks the way for us to actually encounter the actual ugliness of who we are. It's like saying, we used to hold slaves, but we don't now. See, we're good. Women didn't work once. Now they do. See? Right? As if those are affirmations of our inherent goodness. But the problem is the belief in our inherent goodness. So what I want to do is to move from this idea of America to what actually human beings who live in this country have done and are doing. And that becomes the stuff of how we imagine this country moving forward. Now, some would say, well, that's precisely what President Obama was doing. And on a generous read, that might be right. But I want to resist the idea, Carrie, that there's something unique about the idea of America. I want to suggest instead there's something unique about each and every one of us trying to build a life together.
I hear the distinction there. I also know that earlier we talked about mythology and how deeply entwined this idea that there is something about America that's exceptional is in our perception of what it is to be American.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, the French has their version of it.
Absolutely.
The British have their version of it. And it's so deeply rooted in the idolatry of nations, right? And, you know, myth and legend, oh, my goodness. Myth and legend has sustained the illusion that has kept us in the dark for so long. We have to so desperately challenge it because we see just in this election cycle, people trading in the myth and the legend, right? Let's make America great again is about as substantive as hope and change as president as slogans, right? We have to break through the myth and the legend and confront the reality of who we are.
Right? You've mentioned James Baldwin several times. I've asked my guests for the series if there is a writer who has something fresh, and I don't mean necessarily contemporary, but fresh to say to some of these ideas that we've talked about. Is Baldwin yours, or would you choose someone else?
Yeah, no, Jimmy's Baldwin. Mine. I'm working on a book now.
Oh.
It's tentatively titled James Baldwin's Rage and Witness. And Jimmy is, you know, this queer, small black man who was once the darling of the New York intellectuals, who then, you know, dared to speak his truth, offers us such a wonderful and powerful blueprint. To me, he's the inheritor of Emerson. He takes Emerson's vision and brings it across the tracks and gives it, you know, colors it a deep shade of blue. You know, he has this wonderful formulation where he says, the moment we stop conceding to the scripts, the moment we step outside of the orbit of the expectations of us, that's the beginning of revolution. And there's something about the way in which Baldwin thinks about America, but thinks about us individually. You know, he's constantly telling his own story, constantly kind of returning to his own biography in order to possess it so that it can become the basis of his own effort to create himself, right? There's something about what he says that gives me life that I've been trying to think through and wrap my mind around and try to resist that you know, what Ta-Nehisi Coates has written is a reflection of him. But to kind of think about Baldwin as much more of a profound challenge to the country, to me, to you, to us, you know?
You chose, when we asked for music that we could close our conversation with, and I'm sorry we have to close it. I could ask you questions for another hour.
You are amazing.
And right back at you. So what is the, tell me what the significance is of this Molly music song that we're going to hear.
There's something in the sound, you know. It's called I Believe. It's not optimism. It's an enduring hope, a hope that is kind of made manifest against the backdrop of hopelessness. But there's a sound in it, Carrie, that reminds me of home. There's a bluesy pathos in his phrasing that reminds me of the landscape of Mississippi. And what else is Mississippi but a reflection of the deep blues of America? So I thought it was a contemporary iteration of our perennial contradiction.
You sound like you miss Mississippi.
And when I talk about it, I miss my mama.
Eddie, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm so glad you were available to be part of the series.
You made my day. Thank you.
And
this
mine.
Is wonderful.
Eddie Glaude Jr. is a professor of religion at Princeton. He chairs the Department of African American Studies. His newest book is titled Democracy in Black, part of our What It Means to Be an American series of conversation.
Thinking about the world, looking at the nation. Suicide, genocide, homicide. Three words come to mind. Times are changing. Yeah. No more rumors, there are wars going on. Twisted doctor, scientists making clones. Economy got some backs against the wall.
People dying for no reason at all. People of God don't even read their Bibles. There's no faith, no trust in the word. But everybody seems to be quoting scripture. It's just another word they heard. Pastors leaving pulpits cause they're tired. It's all based on how we feel. I overheard two people speaking the other day. One said that God's not real, but I'm just one of them more people who's got a hold on. Sometimes I can't see, but I still believe he's taking care of me. Oh, I'm just one of them old people God's got a hold on.
You can find all of the conversations on the What It Means to Be an American series. Roseanne Cash, Claudia Rankin, Jossie Ross. Find them on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, or check it out at nprnews.org.
No, it ain't perfect, but that's all right. Cause his hand is on me and it's keeping me alive. So many disappointments. So much I don't understand. So much I don't have answers for. That's what makes me trust you more. In a world that's always changing, everything's rearranging.
Tomorrow, I want to hear what you have to say about what it means to be an American. We'll open the phone lines and the social media channels. Think about it between now and then. And join us tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
My God, our view. All I know is one thing nowadays is we all need hope, we all need faith, man. I'm just one of them old people who's got a hope.